This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Just a heads up, this episode contains explicit language and discussion of sex and sex work. It may not be appropriate for young ears. All right, on to the show. Hey, everyone. You're listening to Code Switch from NPR. I'm B.A. Parker.
And I'm Gene Demby.
Now, Gene, I want to talk to you today about a show that I'm absolutely obsessed with.
Oh, I need y'all to say this with me now. Mercedes!
Have you ever watched P-Valley?
You know, Parker, it has been on my list for a long time, but I actually have not gotten a chance to see it yet.
Oh my gosh, you've got to.
So you obviously have feelings. I want to hear all of it. Just lay it all on me.
All right, so listen. It's steamy and saucy and introspective. It contains multitudes.
Okay.
So basically, P-Valley is this dreamy, Southern Gothic, Black womanist soap of a show that that focuses on the lives of strippers in this fictitious town called Chuckalisa, Mississippi. The strippers work at a club called The Pink. That's P-Y-N-K.
What a pink booty battle. First up, we got Blue Cinnamon.
Okay.
And usually the way that strippers are portrayed on TV is this one-dimensional, world-weary single mom.
Mm-hmm. Or the stripper with the heart of gold.
Exactly. But, like, that's not P-Valley. In fact, you can tell from the first bars of the opening theme song that this is not your mama's stripper show.
I don't think my mom has a stripper show.
But, as I said, the show isn't just steamy. You've got these amazing characters. There's the always glamorous Uncle Clifford, who is the owner of the Pink.
Rule number 45.22, leave your baby daddy drama at home.
There's Mercedes, who is the headstrong veteran stripper who keeps trying to retire, but she can't.
Just when she thought she was out, they keep pulling her back in.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, my milkshake brings all the boys to the yard. And what with all I've been doing.
And then there's Keyshawn, who is this dreamer struggling to become a star and dealing with her abusive husband.
Key, what did he say?
He was just hollering and screaming about wearing a mask.
Oh, you got another complaint before.
And the second season of the show, which is wrapping up this month, follows them all as they try to save the Pink from being sold.
So I've seen a lot of discourse around P-Valley, but I haven't obviously seen the show itself. I've seen a lot of people tweeting about, you know, the way it portrays Black women and sex work. I've seen people arguing about whether the accents are accurate, right? Because it's set in Mississippi. I've seen people talking about how beautifully shot it is. And all the people I know in real life who really rock with this show are Southern Black women. I guess you are a connoisseur, right?
Yeah, because we love mess.
Everybody loves mess, though.
But we love mess.
Okay, fair enough.
No, okay. P-Valley first premiered in the summer of 2020 and has gained such a strong following since. The first episode of the second season had more than 4.5 million viewers across platforms.
Oof.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to the mastermind behind this hit show, Katori Hall. And by the way, Jean, Katori Hall is the creator of P-Valley, which is impressive enough on its own, but she's an award-winning playwright. She won the Pulitzer Prize for drama for her 2021 play, The Hot Wing King.
Okay.
And P-Valley started out as a play as well, and it was inspired by her childhood growing up in Memphis, Tennessee.
And I actually grew up, like a lot of folks, I will say, going to strip clubs. Started probably too young, but, you know, when you would go into a club, you would see just this amazing spectacle. I think Southern strip clubs specifically, there tends to be more of a show. It's not just about stripping and taking off your clothes, taking off your top. It's really about these athletic sets that you get to see and throw money at the women, right? And so it was just part of my upbringing in terms of, you know, Southern culture and seeing that and kind of being a participatory observer of the culture. So fast forward, I had moved up to New York, you know, just attending school, living my young adult, fabulous New York City life. And I actually started taking pole dancing classes at Crunch Gym, I remember. And in that moment, I realized how...
How'd that go?
I was just about to say, I almost threw up, actually, on my first day because I was on the pole and I just kept on spinning around and around and around. And then I was like, I'll be right back. I'll be right back. And I, like, had to run to the bathroom. So in that moment, you know, it kind of crystallized for me how hard what these women do is. And I figured out, you know, I should probably make a story out of this. I was, you know, just inspired by the kind of super shiro-ness of the women that I had, you know, grown up seeing on the pole and then trying to do it myself. So I embarked on this 6-year long journey from that point of doing research. I sat across from over 40 women over that time. I went to over 40 strip clubs.
Respect.
Oh, yeah. I did that journalism thing, like really, really did a huge deep dive.
Yo.
I did everything but audition. I was like, man, I should have went up on that stage. I should have, you know, because I had done the class, but I should have just gone ahead and went all the way. But I kind of, you know, that's the thing. It takes a lot of bravery, I think, to do that. And I just wasn't as brave. The play came out of that, all of that. Mm-hmm. And I learned very quickly in 2015, which is when the play Pussy Valley was produced, that it should have been a TV show because there was just so much going on and like so many interesting characters and the dynamics just begged for a deeper exploration that could go on for multiple seasons. And so I decided to go out to LA and pitch it. And I remember like everybody was like clutching their pearls, you know, at my pitch. Because I just think they were like, this is titillating. This is interesting. But there's just like no way in hell that we're going to do a show about strip clubs, you know, black women down south, you know, stripping. Just because it was like a cultural landmine. You know, there's this history of the hypersexualization of black women. And so I just think that people were like very hesitant to take that on. But when I sat down with stars and I explained to them that this was not, you know, this glamorization of strip club culture. It was actually a humanization project that I was embarking on. They really, really understood where I was coming from. And they gave me that shot. They were the only place that said yes. But as my mama always said, all you need is one yes, girl. And you just gone through the dough. What you gonna do with your yes? And so this is my yes.
Oh, my gosh. That's to be on a bumper sticker. What are you going to do with your yes?
Mm-hmm.
For me, the show just, like, every episode feels like a quiet revolution.
Ooh, I love that. I love that.
Yeah, because, like, a lot of that is through the show's black female agency and its queer agency where, you know, strippers are in control of their bodies, which is such an historical contrast to how strippers and their families are typically portrayed in the media. I mean, the biggest episode this season, the one that's been talked about a lot, is like the story of one of the strippers, Mercedes, helping her 14-year-old daughter grapple with the decision of whether or not to get an abortion. In the scene we're about to hear, Mercedes and her daughter Terica are talking about the fact that Mercedes actually got pregnant with Terica as a teenager and had questioned at the time whether or not to get an abortion herself.
You did want an abortion?
I'd be lying if I say I never considered. But that's all I ever did was consider. Because Patrice ain't give me no choice.
She made me have you. And you know what? I'm thankful every day. Because sometimes God uses the devil to give you your blessing.
All I ever wanted was for you to have choices, Terica, and to make them for yourself.
It's a very emotional and very complex scene. And I'm wondering why that issue, the issue of abortion, is something you wanted to tackle in the show.
I think it's because it is so emblematic of just the Black female experience. And I just think it's so important to be honest about everything that we're going through. You know, it's not a lot of us who live at the intersection of race, class, and gender. And to have that intersectional identity, we just don't see the complexity of that often in media. And so I always say we're trying to put vitamins in the Kool-Aid. Like, we want to talk about real stuff that everyone is going through this very specific lens so that it can feel and be universal. I mean, I love when we drop an episode and you see the comments on Twitter or on Facebook or on Instagram, and people are kind of rising up and saying, oh my God, that's me. Mercedes is me. Terica is me. Big Teak is me. We're dealing with issues that, you know, a lot of people don't even want to talk about in their own families. Like, it's not only abortion. We're talking about mental health. We're talking about suicide. And, you know, from the outside, it could be like, oh my God, that's a lot to take on for a TV show. But I think when you, like I said, you're writing about characters that have like a multiple identities that they're dealing with. You know, it just makes sense that what they're going through would resonate with so many different types of people. So we take on a lot, and I feel as though as a Black writer, as a Black female writer, it's kind of my responsibility, right? I have this platform. Millions of people are watching this show. So I think that's one of the main reasons as to why we tell the stories that we do. We tell the kind of deep and dark stories that we do, which, you know, some people have been a little, I would say, they're uncomfortable. They've been made to feel very uncomfortable. But, you know, sometimes it's really hard to look in the mirror. Sometimes it's really hard to look at your reflection, especially when you don't like what you see. But that's the power, I think, in this particular medium of TV, where we are going to just be honest, be true. We use, as I say, fiction in order to tell the truth.
And you just said this great thing about putting the vitamin C in the Kool-Aid. Like, how do you write about these very complex and maybe contentious topics without having the stamp of issue show or without being preachy?
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it's all very character based. It could come off very easily, I think, in the wrong hands as, like you said, very preachy, heavy handed, like even political. But for us, because we've created these characters that feel so real, and we've created characters that people like really want to hang out with, like everybody and their mama want an Uncle Clifford in their life. Everybody want a roulette as their friend, right? Whew. So by tackling these issues and these stories through these characters that, you know, just feel like your homegirl or your homeboy, you know, I think in a weird way, you're able to take in the vitamins a little bit more.
Yeah. And I mean, two of the characters and their storylines that I find particularly interesting is the relationship between Uncle Clifford and Lil Murda. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell us about those characters.
So Uncle Clifford is the owner of the Pink. She has been wrestling with trying to, you know, keep the Pink, you know, in her hands and keep the Pink, you know, fiscally healthy. She is non-binary, but she goes by, she uses she and her pronouns. Mm-hmm. And even in season one, you know, she began to cultivate this in the closet relationship with this up-and-coming trapper rapper named Lil Murda. And initially, it felt like just this kind of lusty sexual connection. But over time, it has grown to be something deeper. I think Lil Murda, in that he is, you know, so masculine, so sexy, like has all this swag and has not been he's honest with himself about, I think, his identity, but I think that he is well aware that, you know, as a rapper who does, you know, gangster rap, if he came out, he knows that he wouldn't be, I would say, embraced. Mm-hmm. And so last season, LaMurda, you know, in an attempt to kind of flex in front of this music executive, he basically dismisses Uncle Clifford, which, you know, hurts her to her core and kind of brings into sharp relief this thing of, can, you know, these two, you know, human beings, one who has a more feminine gender performance and this other one who has a more masculine gender performance, can these two kind of live loudly in the light in a relationship? And so that has been one of the major struggles over the course of these past two seasons for these two particular characters. What I have found so interesting, and I joke about this all the time, I'm like, did I just create, you know, a stripper show so that I could hopefully write one of the best love stories between two Black queer people of all time? Because it's so interesting that people are so invested in this relationship, the will they or won't they make
it.
I'm
here for
it. Everyone, even people who, you know, are low-key homophobic or high-key homophobic, they still...
Because Lil Murda is so tender.
Because he's a tenderoni. He absolutely is a lover, and he's also a fighter.
How come you let me back inside?
Because you needed me, and I needed you.
All right, after the break, we're talking about some other lovers and fighters, the folks on social media who cannot stop arguing over P-Valley.
We just did not know how much there would be an uproar to the point where there was a cancel P-Valley hashtag.
Stay with us, y'all.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the acclaimed true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Parker.
Gene.
Code Switch. Okay, well, Gene, you may have seen this, but earlier this year there was a P-Valley social media uproar that had me feeling some type of way. Basically, there was an episode of the show that featured two scenes that people had very different reactions to. One was a sex scene between two Black women, and the other was between two Black men. And when I saw the discussions happening on Twitter after the episode came out, there seemed to be such a difference in reaction between those two scenes. Now, a lot of the people I saw talking were totally fine with the scene between the two women, but seemed utterly freaked out by the scene between the men. So I asked Katori what she made of that moment and how she decided whether or not to respond.
That moment in particular, I must say, I was really surprised. I mean, by design, we wanted to have those two sex scenes in the same episode, right? We had an inkling that people would be a little bit like, oh, but we just did not know how much there would be an uproar to the point where there was a cancel P-Valley hashtag. that was created.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so I actually got sick with COVID that week. So I was like, is this like God trying to help me or hurt me? Both? I don't know. But so I actually did not respond to that particular hubbub. But my amazing co-EP, Patrick Ian Polk, queer icon who created Noah's Ark, you know, he stepped into the fray for me. And he has had a history of, you know, there being so much just homophobia, and that's been thrown at his work, and to see, you know, what, you know, we thought was a very kind of beautiful sex scene be, you know, seen as or touted as some kind of emasculation project, you know, for Black men. He was just very, very frustrated by that. And so, you know, he basically was like, you know, the gay ain't going nowhere. This may not be for you. Like, and it's true. Like I said before, the gayness, queerness is so important to all of my work, because I want to show all Black people in my work. I'm not just focused on one type of us. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously tweets were going viral that week. And, you know, like I said, that cancel P-Valley hashtag was popping for a minute, child, because they were just up in arms. And I think it has a lot to do with this. We are so comfortable with especially when it comes to the Black male body, you know, for that queerness to look and feel soft and feminine. But when it comes to a more masculine, and dare I say, even hyper-masculine visual articulation of gay Black male identity, it feels like a threat. It brings up these icky feelings of, oh, are there men on the down low trying to, you know, dupe Black women? When in all actuality, it's just that there are some men who are same gender loving men who are probably uncomfortable with being honest with other people as to who they love or who they like because of, you know, the reaction that we got because of the homophobia. And so they're not as expressive, like, yeah, this is my dude, you know. And that is why I think we almost in a weird way kind of proved the point of the entire story. Mm. This is the reason why Big Teak and La Murder aren't like, you know, walking down the streets holding hands, even though they may want to. It's because they know that the world is not interested in that particular articulation of Black gay male identity. So, you know, it's that particular episode, that scene specifically really, really, you know, blew people's minds and disgusted some people. And I always say it's kind of like a Rorschach test, because your reaction to the scene kind of said more about you than anything else. And, you know, it'll continue over the course of the season and has continued over the course of the season. But what I have found super interesting is the same people who are like, I ain't gonna watch P-Valley no more. I ain't gonna watch it. They be watching, child. They watch every episode. And I think that's what a good TV show does. It like, it makes you uncomfortable and you like, oh my God, I'm never gonna watch this show again. Oh, F this show. And then all of a sudden, you know, you at the season finale thinking that you was only going to watch, you know, you weren't going to watch another episode, but you've, you know, ended up watching the whole 10.
Your exploration of Black queerness in the South specifically is a topic that you also dive into in your play, The Hot Wing King, yep, which also featured the actor Nico Anand.
Yes.
Who plays Uncle Clifford on P-Valley.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, why is that a theme that feels important to keep coming back to? Do you feel...
I think that's such a great question. I've been thinking about this a lot, too, because it's like, Katori, you're not a gay Black man. Like, why do you keep on writing these stories that are not necessarily your experience? And real talk, I just think that's what a damn good writer does. Like, I think it's imperative that we write outside of our experience. I think it is healing. I think it is what makes you a dope artist. The fact that I can put myself in the shoes of another person and through my imagination, you know, walk their walk. I also, you know, I do continue to do a lot of research. I know that I don't know everything about what it feels like, what it is like to be Black and queer in the South. And so I ask questions. I do a hell of a lot of research, whether it's, you know, doing interviews with people, which is definitely what I did with the Hot Wing King. I sat down with my brother and his partner, and that's who the play is based on. And I really wanted to hear how it was as these two Black men who just broke through and decided that they were going to be together. Like, just so that people know, like, the Hot Wing King is about two Black gay men in Memphis, Tennessee. And one of them has recently just kind of come out of the closet, is in the midst of a divorce, has sons, like has lived that life, like a hetero life, and has decided that he's going to be true to himself. And over the weekend of as they prepare for a Hot Wing contest, they kind of really, you know, put 10 toes down in terms of their relationship and how they're going to move forward together as a couple. And so the fact that my brother and his partner had lived that life. I wanted to kind of like dedicate this show to their love and to their resilience. And so, yes, it requires a lot of imagination on my part, but I always bake in the truth, especially when it's not exactly my own life experience.
How do you feel when people get called out for writing about communities that other than their own, or for doing it badly?
You know, for me, I have run into some, I would say, tricky interpretations of other communities, you know, from people who are outside of that community. Like when a white person is writing about the Black community in any way. I think what can be your saving grace, and what has been my saving grace, is that I have surrounded myself with people who are from that community in terms of the writer's room. And the fact that when I come to the table, I come with questions more so than answers, because I know that that's not my lived experience.
Yeah. And I mean, like, who is in the writer's room? Like, what kind of perspectives do you rely on to help tell the stories that are very of these very different characters in a way that feels meaningful or satisfying? And like, there, the dreaded word is like authentic, but like, what?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I think that's such a great question. You know, we are, I would say, it's more than half made of women, more than half queer, people who identify as being queer. We always have a dancer or two at the table.
Yes.
For the past two seasons, absolutely. We've had people who have participated in different lanes of sex work, not just stripping.
Mm-hmm.
I also just want people who have different approaches to story. You know, I must say I'm very character centric, and so I try to bring into the fold people who think more about plot, or people who think more about theme, or people who think in symbols. You know, it's just a really, you know, diverse, beautiful, beautiful, grounded, and honest, brutally honest room. And I'm very, very blessed that I have been able to find, as I call them, my hitters.
Yeah. Do you think P-Valley is a fairy tale? Like, there's some magical realism throughout the season, whether it's, you know, talking to ghosts, mm-hmm, or a fear of haints. Mm-hmm. And in one episode, I think someone says, like, a fairy tale is a horror story with a happy ending.
No, it's not a fairy tale at all. And it is so grounded in reality.
This ain't no fairy tale. This the real world. And in the real world, all us got the power to rewrite our own destinies. Handsome princes can become fire-breathing dragons. trusty sidekicks can become angels of death, and even damsels can become their own damn saviors.
I do think some people get their fairy tale, but as in life, just like in a TV show, because you get to do it over and over again, you know, there's some days that feel better than others for our characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I don't think that P-Valley will ever participate in a kind of like complete happy ending for any of our characters. And it's interesting because I know that a lot of our audience members, they need that. But I just think that to speak honestly about what is happening today, especially with where the show is set, we just have to be way more honest and real. But I do think that some people can get their fairy tales. I think the characters that get that have to grind for that fairy tale. I do think that despite all the darkness, there is light in Chuckalisa, but it's just not every day.
Once again, that was Katori Hall. She's the creator of the show P-Valley, which is just wrapping up its second season on Stars.
All right, Parker, I'm convinced. I'm going to move this up my queue, my to-watch queue. I'm going to start watching the show this week. On your suggestion,
success,
after this conversation.
Because, you know, I'm going to need someone to watch season 3 with me.
I got you.
And that's our show. We want to hear from you. Email us at codeswitch@npr.org. You can follow us on IG and Twitter. We're at NPR Codeswitch. Subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter.
This episode was produced by Alyssa Jong Perry and edited by Leah Donella and Dahlia Mortada. And a shout out to the rest of the Code Switch Massive: Karen Grisby Bates, Christina Kala, Kumari Devarajan, Jess Kung, Summer Tomad, Deepa Motisham, and Steve Drummond.
I'm B.A. Parker.
And I'm Gene Demby. Be easy, y'all.
Hydrate. Hey there. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to our Code Switch Plus listeners. We appreciate you and thank you for being a subscriber. Subscribing to Code Switch Plus means getting to listen to all of our episodes without any sponsor breaks. And it also helps support our show. So if you love our work, please consider signing up at plus.npr.org/codeswitch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.